All right, good evening, everybody. It's very nice to have you here, all 154 of you joining us tonight. It's Friday, June the 8th. It's early evening Eastern Standard Time, and I'm delighted to have with me so many enthusiastic students and followers and scholars of Austrian economics who just happen to be nerdy enough not to have anything better to do on a Friday night. But I'm looking in the mirror here. But it's really a delight to have you here. This is the introductory lecture, or the teaser lecture, for my six-week course in Austrian microeconomics, which is coming up next month. And so the course begins on the 5th of July, and it costs $59 for the six-week course. But we thought we would do a little preview of the course tonight, absolutely free, to give you a sense of what the course is about, talk a little bit about how things will work, give you an overview of the course topics, let you check out the technology if you haven't done a Mises Academy course before. Hopefully things are working for you now, and we have a great technical support team willing and able to help you with any issues that come up. So what we're going to do tonight is really just a brief overview and introduction. So this is not a full lecture for the course. This is really more of a teaser. And Bob Murphy suggested to me the other day that that I was sort of behaving as an instructor for the course, a little bit like a crack dealer. So you give a few free samples out in the beginning, hoping that people will get addicted, and then you jack up the price later on. And it is true that I have been forbidden in most states from giving my lectures anywhere near an elementary school. But nonetheless, I'm here to offer this for you tonight. And I do hope that those of you who have not yet signed up for the full course will consider doing so after we get finished with the intro tonight. I think you'll find that it's well worth your time and the small amount of money that it costs to sign up for the course. So again, what I'm going to do tonight is tell you a little bit about myself, tell you a little bit about the subject of the course, and go over some of the logistics and practicalities for how things will work. I see from the chat window that it's a pleasure to have some students that I've had before in other Mises Academy courses, or that I've met in other settings. So some of you know me already. I'm Peter Klein. You can look me up. Most of you probably already have on the course webpage. There's a little bit of a biography. I'm a professor at the University of Missouri in Columbia, Missouri. And I've been affiliated with the Mises Institute for many years, more than 20 years now, starting from my graduate student days. So I am a senior fellow, senior scholar with the Institute, and lecture frequently at Institute conferences and other events. I've been a devotee of the Austrian school for many, many years, and an enthusiastic supporter of Austrian economics, and want to tell you a little bit more about Austrian economics tonight, what Austrian economics is, what I think it is, how I see it, what I think we can do with it, and so on. So that's really why we wanted to have this microeconomics course, was to introduce you to, as the course description says, Austrian accounts of value, price, exchange, what in many ways are the heart of the Austrian tradition. And that's worth mentioning because it isn't at all obvious to students and scholars within the Austrian tradition that microeconomics is really where it's at. Why do I say that? Well, let's turn to the slides for a moment here. If I were to ask you, what is Austrian economics? And maybe some of you have been asked by your friends or family members, and you've asked yourself, what exactly is this thing that we call Austrian economics or Austrianism? Well, when you hear the term Austrian economics, a lot of different terms come to people's minds. You might think about something like spontaneous order or subjectivism, the free market, right? The Austrian school is often associated with a free market stance in political economy. Maybe you think of a specific debate or an issue within the school, or an application like the famous socialist calculation debate of the 1920s and 1930s. Maybe you think about business cycle theory. And of course, a lot of people have been drawn to the Austrian school since the financial crisis in 2008, as people have been increasingly looking for alternative explanations for the financial crisis and the recession. There's been a huge revival of interest in the business cycle theory of the Austrian economists, and that is one of the unique hallmarks of the Austrian tradition. Maybe think about sort of technical issues like disequilibrium or the so-called market process as a different way of thinking about economics, a different way about understanding markets than you get within more mainstream approaches to economics. Now, all of these issues are, to one degree or another, rightfully associated with the Austrian tradition. They're useful markers or descriptors or applications of Austrian economics. But I want to suggest tonight that these things are not really the hallmark, not really the distinct brand of the Austrian approach. And to see that, we might go back to the founder of the Austrian tradition, the Viennese economist Karl Menger. Karl Menger, as most of you know, founded the Austrian tradition with his, you know, landmark treatise published in 1871 called Principles of Economics, or that's the English translation of the German title. The German edition was published in 1871, an English edition some years later. If you've never looked at Menger's Principles, I highly recommend it. It's an outstanding overview of the core of Austrian economics. It's very easy to read, very straightforward. It doesn't presume any background knowledge in Austrian economics or in economics of any kind. And yet it has a lot of depth. It's by no means a lightweight principles textbook. It's very, very dense and meaty. If you look at the table of contents of Menger's Principles of Economics, what do you see? Well, here's the table of contents. I've reproduced it for you right here on the slide. First chapter, the general theory of the good. And here, of course, Menger means goods in the economic sense of goods, not an ethical theory of good versus bad. Economy and economic goods, the theory of value, the theory of exchange, the theory of price, use value and exchange value, or the differences between use value and exchange value, the theory of the commodity, and the theory of money. And that's it, right? That's the end of the book. There's really nothing in here about spontaneous order and disequilibrium and institutions and these sorts of more kind of esoteric topics. But Menger really sticks to the basics, right? Plain vanilla economics. What are economic goods? What is value in an economic sense? What does it mean to exchange things? How are goods and services priced? He does a little bit on the theory of money. But does not present a full-fledged kind of macroeconomic theory with capital and interest, business cycle, etc. Menger had planned to produce a second volume of his treatise that would cover macroeconomics, what we now call macroeconomics, and more applications. Unfortunately, he never did. But the point I'm making here is that the founding document, the founding contribution to the Austrian tradition is really about what we now call microeconomics, or more accurately, price theory, the theory of value and exchange and price. That is, at least in Menger's view, that's the core of the Austrian tradition. So, again, Menger focuses on what I have called, in a 2008 article, mundane economic topics, not esoterica. Right? It isn't that Menger and his followers didn't think that esoteric subjects were interesting or important. Rather, that they were secondary to the hard core of what I call mundane Austrian economics. Right? Mundane is a word that means ordinary, everyday, commonplace. So the things that come to most people's minds when they think about economics, they think about prices and markets and exchanges, production, consumption, financial markets, firms, bankruptcies, business cycles, and so on. think this is ordinary, everyday economic stuff. And I think the essence of Austrian economics, the hallmark of the Austrian tradition, what makes it distinct and unique from other approaches to economics is its treatment of these mundane topics. You can look up my article in the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics from 2008 if you want more detail. Now, let me step back for a moment. If you talk to most conventional historians of economic thought, they would identify as Menger's main contribution his emphasis on, or the idea of, subjective utility, that consumer valuations are not objectively given, they're not, values are not determined by the quantity of labor that went into the production of a good or service, as the classical economists and Karl Marx held, but rather that value is subjective and comes from the subjective preferences of consumers. That is one of Menger's major contributions, and Menger, along with Leon Walras and William Stanley Jevons, writing in Switzerland and England, respectively, around the same time, Menger developed the notion of marginal analysis, that prices are determined by marginal utilities, not total utilities. Now, both Walras and Jevons, who presented different kinds of mathematical statements of subjective utility and marginal analysis, right? I mean, Menger, Walras, and Jevons are rightly treated together as being the sort of simultaneous independent discoverers of the marginalist approach to microeconomics. However, subjectivism per se, marginal analysis per se, are not the unique markers of Menger's approach, right? Menger's approach is quite different from the approaches of Walras and Jevons. Now, because Menger's treatise is verbal, right? Walras and Jevons expressed their ideas of marginalism in mathematics, whereas Menger wrote in words, right? Some commentators have interpreted Menger's treatise as just a verbal representation, you could even say a verbal restatement, if you like, of mathematical neoclassical economics. But that is an erroneous interpretation. Menger's approach is very much different from that of Jevons and Walras, not simply the fact that he uses words rather than mathematics, but in the following two aspects. That Menger is essentially an Aristotelian for providing a scientific theory of economic phenomena based on cause and effect. That's very different from the neoclassical approach to explaining market phenomena, which emphasizes a notion of simultaneous determination and equilibrium that comes from 19th century classical mechanics. Now, Menger does have notions of equilibrium, and equilibrium is important within the causal approach, but it's interpreted very differently than it is in neoclassical economics. So Menger is seeking to explain economic phenomena, prices, quantities, exchange, other kinds of market behavior, as the result of some previous fundamental causes. So it's a causal analysis. Of course, causal analysis is completely out of fashion in the physical sciences, and rightly so in the physical sciences, but also in the social sciences. So the Austrians are very much out of step with mainstream economists in their insistence that economics can be a logical and causal discipline and not simply an imitation of 19th century physics. So causality is the first identifying characteristic. And the second is Menger's focus on real market behavior. In other words, Menger's analysis is not supposed to explain some hypothetical price that would obtain under certain stylized conditions. It's not designed to create some, it's not designed to be a model that simulates somehow some kinds of prices that, you know, would emerge under some hypothetical set of circumstances. No, Menger is interested in explaining, you know, real economic prices, right? The real prices of real goods and services. I have a water bottle in front of me. I bought it out of the vending machine that's here at the university. I think they charge $1.50. Which is obviously a monopoly price for this bottle of water, right? But Menger wants to know, why is this actual bottle of Dasani water purchased by Peter Klein on June the 8th, 2012, why is that price $1.25? Why isn't it $2.25? Why isn't it 75 cents? Why isn't it $50 or whatever? Menger wants to explain real prices, real transactions, real exchange phenomena. So if we combine the Aristotelian causal approach with the emphasis on explaining real phenomena, we get what Joe Salerno and I have called causal realist economics. So Menger's economics, and I would argue the economics of Menger's, of the Austrian tradition, that comes from Menger and his followers and developers and successors, that Austrian tradition is essentially the causal realist way of analyzing market phenomena. That's what distinguishes Austrian economics from neoclassical economics. It's that Austrian economics is causal and realistic. So what exactly do we mean by causal and realistic? Well, I'll elaborate a little bit and give you a couple of examples coming from Menger, right? The classical economists, Adam Smith, Ricardo, Say, and so forth, they were great innovators in, you know, coming up with an analysis of prices, explanations for market phenomena based on supply and demand. The problem with classical school was not its, you know, not its general approach to markets, but this idea, the classical economists' erroneous, mistaken value theory, right? They adopted a kind of objective approach to economic value, holding that prices were really determined by the objective characteristics of goods and services. For example, the amount of labor that went into them, the famous labor theory of value that is adopted by Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations, even though, curiously, Adam Smith embraced a more subjectivist, we would now say correct, approach to valuation in his lectures on jurisprudence, which were published several years prior to The Wealth of Nations. So the classical economists, you know, they thought of valuation purely in terms of you know, kind of monetary calculation. They really were only interested in the supply side. What does it cost the businessman in money to produce goods and services? So it was an exclusively supply side characteristic, supply side approach to explaining prices. Consumers were really passive players whose behaviors were not really investigated, not really well understood by the classicals. Now, Menger was a great enthusiast for classical economists, for classical economics, and just as a footnote, you know, while Menger's approach was in many ways revolutionary, you know, Menger did not see himself as breaking entirely from the classical tradition. And you know, maybe 20 years ago, there was some excitement when Menger's notebooks were discovered from the period when Menger had been the private tutor to Prince Rudolf, the Crown Prince of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Menger was hired to be Rudolf's private tutor, and Rudolf, as you know, tragically committed suicide in the days leading up to the First World War. People have sometimes wondered if Rudolf had acceded to the throne, and we had a Mengerian Austrian economist in charge of the empire, things might have gone very differently. But anyway, when Menger's notebooks were examined by scholars a few decades ago, these scholars expressed surprise that Menger did not appear to be teaching the Crown Prince Menger's own subjectivist, marginalist, you know, radical economics, but rather Menger was teaching right out of Adam Smith. He had the Crown Prince read The Wealth of Nations, and Menger taught pretty straightforward classical economics. And some people have thought, well, this was for political reasons. Menger didn't want to teach anything too controversial to protect his job. Or alternatively, it's been suggested that Menger didn't really appreciate how radical his own innovations were. But I think a better interpretation is that Menger thought that the classical political economy was pretty much on target, with a few exceptions. Obviously that its value theory was wrong, but that its basic analysis of supply and demand was pretty good. So what Menger did is he reconstituted or restructured or revitalized the classical tradition by injecting into it the correct subjective theory of value. Subjective value theory dates at least back to the Spanish scholastics of the 15th and 16th and 17th centuries, maybe even earlier than that. There were some German economists in Menger's day who members of the so-called older historical school, who had embraced the correct subjective theory of value. And so Menger wanted to reconstruct the classical tradition on the basis of subjective marginal utility theory. In other words, to look at my little diagram here, sort of the outcomes of our explanation, the explananda, these objective real-world prices, the prices that are used by entrepreneurs in their calculations. In other words, the fact that it really is the case that Peter Klein would pay $1.25 for this bottle of water. That's good. I think I got at least $1.15 worth of benefit just out of that one sip. Menger wanted to explain these real phenomena or trace them back to the purely subjective valuations that underlie or are manifest in consumer choices. In other words, the reason that I was willing to pay that price, the reason that the seller was willing to give up the bottle for that price, this has to do with our subjective states of mind, our preferences, as we would say today. And it's these preferences, as revealed in action, that are the causal determinants of real market phenomena. Okay? So again, we're emphasizing cause and effect rather than mutual determination. And, for example, if you look at Menger's definition of an economic good, which is at the very beginning of the principles, right? And this is quite different from the way most conventional textbooks, neoclassical economics textbooks do it. Menger says to constitute an economic good, an element of the external world, a physical good or a set of services that can be exchanged, the following four conditions must be placed. There has to be a human need, my need to have my thirst quenched, for example. Such properties as render, this is the translation of Menger's text, right? Such properties as render the thing capable of being brought into causal connection with the satisfaction of this need. In other words, there must be some aspects, some properties of this good that give it a causal connection to satisfying my thirst, right? It is capable of satisfying my thirst because of the properties of the chemistry and so on. That is satisfying. Third, there must be human knowledge of this causal connection, right? In other words, a water bottle that could satisfy somebody's thirst but is in the middle of a forest and nobody hears it. Okay, sorry, that analogy doesn't quite work. If nobody knows about the water bottle, then it's not an economic good, right? It's only an economic good when it has the ability to satisfy a particular want, and at least one human actor is aware of these characteristics, is aware of this ability, right? And fourth, there must be human actors with command of the thing sufficient to direct it to the satisfaction of the need. In other words, if I'm on a ship that's stranded in the ocean, I'm on a boat that's run out of fuel and I'm floating in a saltwater ocean and I don't have any water, I'm dying of thirst, whatever, and there's one of these water bottles floating by in the ocean, but I can't reach it. I don't have a tool to haul it in. I don't have a way to steer the boat over to it. I can see it with my eyes, but it just goes on floating by and I can never reach it. Well, you know, for me, that bottle of water is not an economic good, right? It's not an economic good for me because I have no means for, you know, acting upon that thing to make it able to satisfy my need. So notice, it's not the purely physical characteristics of the commodity that are sufficient to make it an economic good. It's just, you know, the bottle, it's the same bottle of water, whether I'm holding, physically, the same bottle of water, whether I'm holding it in my hand, or whether it's floating out to sea. But from an economic point of view, that's a critical difference. If I can't get to it, then it is not for me an economic good. So, you know, this is just, yeah, I don't have Jedi powers, by the way, from those who were asking. So it's just a pretty straightforward definition of a good. It's early in Menger's principles. But you see, from the very beginning, he's infusing his discussion with this Aristotelian sort of causal notion. Another example that we'll discuss in more detail once the course begins, in either the first or the second lecture, is something that some of you are familiar with already. You know, what Austrians call the structure of production with lower order goods and higher order goods, right? So if you think about bread, for example, bread being, you know, an economic, sorry, bread being an economic good that can satisfy, you know, a consumer's want. It satisfies Menger's four conditions, but that bread is itself produced by yet other economic goods, right? The inputs into bread, flour and ovens and the labor of the bakers, those are also economic goods, but they are not consumed directly by the consumer. They are rather the goods that are used to produce the bread that is consumed directly. They're factors of production, in other words. And, you know, but the flour, the ovens, and so forth, they are, you know, they don't just stand alone. They are themselves the product of yet a higher order good, the wheat and the grain mills and so on that went into producing them. And then there were, you know, there's farming stuff that goes into producing those things. And then there's the factory where the, you know, farming equipment was made and so on. We could go back, you know, sort of ad infinitum. But, you know, one of Menger's great contributions in the theory of factor pricing, which we'll also discuss, right, is to point out that the value of the value of the flour and the ovens is imputed from the value of the bread, right? So consumers value bread. That gives value to the inputs into bread, which then gives value into the inputs, and so on and so forth. So, you know, bread is what Menger calls a lower order good, and then these others are higher, successively higher order goods. But Menger describes this structure production approach, and he uses the term the causal nexus of goods. In other words, valuation, right, is a causal relationship from consumers' value for lower order goods to the higher order goods that are used to produce them. It's sometimes called the Austrian theory of imputation. As Menger puts it, the process by which goods of higher order are progressively transformed into goods of lower order, and by which these are directed finally to the satisfaction of human needs, is not irregular, but subject, like all other processes of change, to the law of causality. Okay, so there's not any sort of random, arbitrary relationships among these different factors that are in the causal nexus of goods, but rather they're all linked together through processes of causality. And, you know, by the way, thinking about cause and effect in, you know, Aristotelian terms also gives us, reminds us of the importance of time. The production of goods and services in the Austrian approach takes place through calendar time. Right, and those of you who have studied Austrian economics before know about, you know, so-called time preference, the relationship between time preference and interest, the fact that we can't, you know, get goods and services produced instantaneously. There's uncertainty and the risk of error, right? Bread entrepreneur has to invest in buying flour and renting ovens and so forth before he's produced and sold any bread. And there's, of course, a risk that he won't be able to sell the bread for a high enough revenue. His revenues from the sale of bread won't be enough to cover his costs for buying the factors and so on. So we have time, uncertainty, the prospect of profit and loss, entrepreneurship. All of these are kind of embodied in or implied by Menger's causal approach to economic analysis. What about realism? Well, it's sort of as a curious note, as some of you may know, Menger's profession before becoming a scholar was, does anybody know? Well, there's a hint on the slide right there. Exactly, Menger was a journalist. Right, he was a financial reporter for one of the largest German language newspapers in Vienna and elsewhere. And Menger was like the guy on CNBC doing the stock market report, you know, what different companies were doing, which companies were doing well, and how, you know, industrial data on, you know, industrial production and, you know, market conditions and so on. So, you know, Menger, you know, he wrote his principles treatise to try to make sense of the phenomena that he saw around him every day as a journalist, right? So he wasn't just, you know, this wasn't an exercise, kind of an abstract mental exercise in just to sort of satisfy his intellectual curiosity. Economics was not, for Menger, mental gymnastics. It was an attempt to explain real phenomena, okay? We won't have a chance to talk much about the socialist calculation debate in this course. Maybe we will at some point. But one of the key issues in the debate between Ludwig von Mises and F.A. Hayek and others against the socialist economists and the so-called market socialists of the 1930s over whether a socialist economy could allocate resources in a rational manner, this debate really hinged upon different interpretations of pricing and the pricing process. Mises, as you may recall, wrote this pathbreaking essay in 1920 pointing out that socialist economic planners would not be able to allocate resources to their highest value uses, even if they wanted to, even if they were benevolent, you know, not corrupt, evil jerks or whatever. Even if they wanted to allocate resources efficiently, they would not be able to do so because they would not have market prices to guide them in their allocation of resources. Market prices, of course, give information about relative scarcities, about consumer demands, and are used by entrepreneurs to determine ex post whether their decisions have been correct or incorrect. Without any prices for factors of production, and under socialism, the state would own all the factors of production. The state would own all the steel and direct all the labor and so forth. You wouldn't have markets, Mises argued, for factors, so there would be no exchange of factors, no prices for factors, and then no way for the socialist planners to calculate. Well, some economists in the 1930s took up Mises' challenge. People like Oscar Lange and Ava Lerner, Fred Taylor, and came up with what they thought and what many neoclassical economists have thought was a devastating reply to Mises. They said, no, the centralist planners can just use a mathematical equation, right? They can simulate the real market. They can, with enough computing power and enough data on scarcities and preferences and so forth, they could, you know, run things through a computer and come up with, let the computer choose the prices. And this would be just as good as the actual market, maybe even better if the computer can, you know, take account of externalities and all that sort of thing. So really this difference in viewpoint between the Austrians and the defenders of socialism had to do with what prices are and what markets are, right? If you think that the prices that are spit out of a computer, programmed with a, you know, solving a linear programming problem, if those prices are okay, well then fine, a computer can do a great job, right? But Mises always emphasized that what we're interested in is the prices that emerge on real markets, real prices. We're not interested in computer-generated prices. We're not interested in shadow prices. We're not interested in pseudo prices, we're interested in real prices. And the only way you get real prices, according to Mises, is to have real markets where real goods and services are exchanged, which implies private ownership of goods and services, private property, and therefore that of course is incompatible with socialism. One other point too, even though Austrian economics is often regarded as a you know, as sort of a highly abstract theoretical discipline. And Austrian economists are very enthusiastic about economic history, right? Now, they have some differences with neoclassical economists. For example, Austrians don't think that you use the data of history to sort of prove theory, to test theory or prove theories to be correct. Most Austrians, following Mises, believe that theory can be derived deductively, but yet theory has to be applied to concrete real-world cases, right? The idea that, the idea of the law of demand, for example, that, that a lower price, a larger quantity will be demanded, other things equal. That can be derived logically from first principles, but that doesn't, the fact that the demand curve is downward sloping, that doesn't tell us much about the demand for water bottles in Columbia, Missouri in 2012. But for that, we need some detailed historical analysis. So Austrians are, of course, totally interested in the real world. Don't let anybody tell you, oh, well, you Austrians, you know, you're just pie in the sky theory guys. No, not at all. We Austrians are realistic, and we're interested in history and in the real world. And we think we can do a better job explaining the real world than neoclassical economists can. Okay, having said all that, let me tell you a little bit more about how this course is going to work. Now, this is an intermediate course, by which I mean that, we're going to move at a fairly rapid pace. And I know that many of you who are signed up for the course have already had Bob Murphy's course called Principles of Economics. Now, that is not, I want to emphasize, Bob Murphy's course is not in any way a formal prerequisite for this course. The course is perfectly well suited to beginners who have not had Murphy's course or any previous course in economics. But, we have this, within the Mises Academy, have been working on this certificate program where we integrate several courses together. So our idea is that if you take the Principles of Economics course from Bob Murphy that just concluded, and then you take this course, Austrian Microeconomics, and then a future course that Joe Salerno is going to teach, which does not yet have a title or on the schedule, but will be, something on, macroeconomic topics, capital and interest, the theory of monetary theory, business cycle theory, and so on. The idea is that if you take all three of those, you are, sort of fully trained and certified in Austrian economic theory, and we'll even give you a certificate called Austrian Economics Level 1 if you take all three of those courses. Now, again, that doesn't mean you have to take the Murphy course before taking mine. I haven't looked into this, but the Murphy course, the lectures, I'm sure, are still available in archive format if you want to sign up for that ex post. Anybody who wants to do the reading and put some effort into it will do great in this course, whether you've had the previous principles course or not. But in other words, we're going to cover, our scope is somewhat narrower than the principles course, but we're going to go a little bit deeper. Okay, so we're not going to do a general overview of all aspects of Austrian economics, but just a more detailed study of Austrian micro or Austrian price theory. There are six sessions. They're going to be on Thursday nights, beginning on July the 5th. 6:30 to 8:30 Eastern Standard Time. That will include a brief, maybe 45-minute lecture, followed by questions and answers. And I do hope that we'll have a lot of discussion in the course. I'll give a little overview lecture, but I hope that we'll have plenty of opportunity for discussion in the chat window, through the Q&A window, and so on. There will be some readings. Somebody has asked if the reading is going to be from Menger. No, if they're not already on the main course page, they will be on there soon. But I have a selection of readings, all of them available online, from some other Austrian texts. In fact, let me see if I have the hard copy of Shapiro. Well, darn it. I can't find it on my bookshelf there, but there's a wonderful economics textbook called Foundations of the Market Price System by Milton Shapiro. The Institute has it available online. It's highly underutilized, I think maybe because it was produced back in the 1980s. It's a very, very low-tech production. It looks like it was typed out on an old typewriter that with the drawings being handwritten. So it's not slick like a conventional textbook, but it's really, really good. There'll be some readings from that and then a few other selections from some other texts that will be made available to you online. If you've taken another Mises Academy course, you know this, but Mises Academy courses can be taken for a grade, but it is not required, right? So if you want to get a grade for taking this course, all you have to do is take the quizzes that will be made available to you each week starting after the first week of the course. These will be short online quizzes. I think you get the grades instantly, and we will give you an A, B, C, whatever, based on your performance on those quizzes. If you don't want a grade, that's fine. You don't have to take the quizzes, but you're welcome to take them if you like. I certainly welcome any questions, comments, discussions that you want to have outside of our regular weekly meetings. Best way to reach me, of course, is by email. You can email me at my Mises address, dkline@mises.org. You can call me at my office phone number, which is given there, but I'm only part-time in the office. I don't spend that much time in my office, but I guess I could check my voicemail. It seems so old-fashioned, but you can call me or email me. If you have any technical issues or problems, you can just email that academy@mises.org. And by the way, yes, somebody in response to a chat question. Yeah, sorry, the quizzes are multiple choice quizzes, so they're all pretty straightforward. What will we do in the course? Well, it's laid out as follows, and this information is available or will soon be available on the main course page. We'll start with the very basics of subjective valuation, concepts of scarcity, purposeful human choice, how we go about valuing things as individuals, and we'll discuss some applications and some puzzles and problems and criticisms of the Austrian approach. And then we'll move on to the theory of exchange, right? How do we get from subjective preferences to a demand schedule or a demand curve if we were to draw it as a picture? And how does that influence consumer behavior in exchanging? And then we'll get to really the heart of the course, the theory of price determination. Given that we have buyers and sellers with different preferences, how do their interactions determine the prices that are paid? And I think the Austrians have a unique approach to price determination. It was it's sketched out by Menger, but not really developed in detail until a little bit later, in particular by the works of the British economist Philip Lichtenstein, who was an Austrian in the broad sense, though of course not Viennese by nationality. Then we'll take a little break. Actually, some of you, I hope many of you, will be at the Mises University summer conference. And so we'll take a break during the week of Mises U because I'll be fully occupied with my duties there, and some of you will be as well. But then the week after Mises University, we'll start back up with a discussion of Austrian production theory and the role of the business firm. We'll then talk about profit, loss, and the entrepreneur. I think entrepreneurship is a fascinating topic within the Austrian school. It's a much misunderstood, both within and outside the Austrian tradition. But I'm going to try to argue that the entrepreneur plays a fundamental role in the basic processes of pricing and exchange. Then we'll talk a little bit about market structure, the different notions of competition, what is the Austrian approach, or what are some Austrian approaches to monopoly. And then we'll be done. That's a lot to pack into 6 short meetings. And by no means will we be able to cover all of the critical issues and points and things that are interesting. I'd like you to think of this course as more of a sampler or as kind of something to whet your appetite about Austrian microeconomics. I'm hopeful that some of you will want to go on to even deeper study. Whether we'll do it as a Mises Academy course or not, I don't know. But you know, hopefully after this course, you'll be equipped to go through a much more detailed treatment like Rothbard's Man, Economy, and State, or even better, Mises' Human Action. Human Action is not an easy book to read, as some of you, those of you who have tried to read it, can attest. And I rarely suggest it to newcomers to the Austrian tradition. People who want to, what is Austrian economics all about? I've never studied economics in any way, can you teach me? And you dump a copy of Human Action on their lap. I'm second to none in my admiration for Mises' treatise, but I don't think it's a good primer. However, having taken our course, you'll be fully equipped to jump right in to Human Action. Erase. So I guess that's about it. I'm looking forward to seeing many of you, hopefully most of you, in July when we begin the formal course. So that's it for me. Let's have some questions now. I'm going to look in the I'm looking through the Q&A window rather than the chat window. So give me a second to make it larger. There we go. Okay, so I'm just going to start at the beginning of the chat queue here. Yes, that was Joe Salerno lurking in the background in that dark and shadowy figure that some of you saw for a moment there. And you'll get to see more of him later if you sign up for the course that he's going to do. I already said a little bit about the text. As far as readings that you should do in advance, Menger's Principles would be a great introduction. But also, as soon as the readings are posted on the Academy page, I would go ahead and start looking at the Shapiro book, the selections from the Shapiro book, the selections from the other items that are there as well, as way of background. Now, I know that some of you are, are currently college students, maybe high school students or even graduate students who are taking a kind of mainstream standard course or have already taken courses. And, certainly reading through mainstream economics materials would be fine as a way of, would help give you something, maybe some context, would help you to see some of the differences between the Austrian approach that I'm going to present and some of those more mainstream approaches. But of course, that certainly isn't necessary. And I'm delighted to have lots of attendees who are not students, not currently full-time students, but are, like me and all of us, students in the broad sense. Leandro, there will be a certificate offered for the course. And like I say, if you take the principles course and the macro course, you can get a fancier certificate that indicates that you've taken the entire sequence. Okay. I'm going to focus on some of the broader questions here and for the moment not answer some of the more technical questions. For example, Weiser's approach to monopoly. I won't primarily be talking about Weiser. I'll be talking mainly about Mises, Kirchner, and Rothbard. But we certainly can talk about Weiser if you like. I wouldn't say that Weiser is neglected within the modern, within the Austrian tradition. He certainly is not as important a figure as Menger, as Weiser's contemporary von Bavert, as Mises, Hayek, Rothbard, and so on. But Weiser is an extremely influential person, and at least some approaches within the Austrian school. For example, Hayek was Weiser's student. Hayek was not a student of Mises. Hayek already had his PhD before he encountered Mises for the first time. Of course, in many ways, Hayek is rightly described as a follower of Mises or, a fellow traveler of Mises, whatever. But Hayek and many of Hayek's contemporaries, in fact, most of Hayek's contemporaries in the early 20th century, were trained at Vienna by Weiser. And Weiser's approach was quite a bit different from von Bavert's, von Bavert being the mentor of Mises. And so there is a strong Beezerian influence in the Austrian school, and it's quite a bit different from the more conventional Austrian approach. It's a little bit quirky. So I'd say Beezer doesn't get as much attention as some of the other figures, but I think that's appropriate given that Beezer's contribution is a little bit quirkier. Craig is asking, is it true that all economics for Austrians, all economics is microeconomics? I mean, there's a sense in which I agree with you, and right, we Austrians do not generally accept the conventional sort of artificial distinction between micro and macro. Those labels may make sense for certain purposes. In other words, for doing these courses, I might speak loosely of the micro course that deals primarily with prices and exchange and so forth, as opposed to a macro course that deals more with money and business cycles. But, we don't think that there are sort of two independent branches of economics. And by the way, if you took, those of you who took economics in college, in the 70s, the whole tradition of economic textbooks coming from Paul Samuelson really does put this huge split between the two. But you can take a macroeconomics course as a standalone thing. You can take a microeconomics course, but they're totally independent. You don't need one for the other. I certainly wouldn't agree with that. All good Austrian economics, whether it's talking about monetary theory, monetary policy, business cycles, sort of issues, things that deal with the economy as a whole, we always understand those aggregate phenomena in terms of the choices and actions and beliefs of individuals, right? So all good economics is micro in the sense that Austrians, strictly adhere to what is sometimes called methodological individualism. So we reject the idea that you can explain one aggregate in terms of another aggregate, or that aggregates act upon other aggregates, as in old-fashioned Keynesian macroeconomics. Increase in the money supply causes change in output, change in prices, and so on. No, causal relations are only at the level of individuals, not at the level of aggregate. Okay. There's a question from Mike about obviously from an Android fan. Yes and no. Yes, short answer is yes. We will talk about those kinds of things.
Peter, sorry to interrupt.
Yeah.
Could you read the questions, because some of the students can't see each other's questions?
I'm sorry. Thank you, Danny, for pointing that out. I was assuming that you guys could see what's in the question. I'm sorry. Messink has asked, would you be able to explain how a consumer would choose to spend more on an inferior product, his example is an iPad 3, versus an Android tablet with a more robust feature set and a greater performance and is cheaper? In other words, for Mike, clearly an Android tablet is superior to the iPad 3. Why would some people still buy an iPad 3? I mean, yes, we will talk about that. The short answer is, again, precisely because of this idea that value is subjective, right? So for people who prefer an iPad 3, it actually is a better product. In other words, it's better able to satisfy their needs, just as some people might not like to drink water and they might prefer to drink something else, or maybe I don't really have water in here. Maybe I was lying to you earlier and I had vodka in here, and I prefer vodka to water, even though other people would prefer water to vodka. So yes, we will talk about the inherent subjectivity of economic valuation. I'm going to skip some of the questions that I don't want to ask. Some of these are technical questions about demand and how you do supply and demand analysis. For right now, I'm just going to say, if I were selling a book, I'd say buy the book. In other words, my answer to technical questions about the demand curve and how you use the demand curve, my answer is take the course. Plunk down your $59, and I will tell you. Okay. Other questions: will the lectures be recorded? Someone is asking. Yes, they will. If you have to miss a class because you you know, you have another, you're taking a class at the same time, or for whatever reasons you might have to miss in a particular week, yes, the lectures and the Q&A sessions will be recorded, and I'm sure that, I believe the chat transcripts are available as well, so you won't miss that at all. Will I use any calculus? No, not at all. There might be, you know, if somebody asks a question about how to interpret something in calculus terms, I might be able to help with that. But no, this is not a calculus-based course. There's a question about applications of price theory, like price floors and price ceilings. I will try to cover that as much as we have time. I mean, in a longer course, I would devote an entire section to applications of price theory, such as price controls, but we probably will have time to do it only briefly, but we will do it. There's some questions about the logistics of the quizzes. We'll give you more information about that later. Typically, what we have done is make the quiz available, you know, shortly after each lecture. So the lectures are on Thursday. Thursdays, ideally, we would have the quiz ready for you Friday or at the very latest Saturday. And there's usually a window in which you can take the quizzes, maybe up to a full week. So you might have any time, you know, within that week or 6 days or whatever to take the quiz. So, you know, you don't have to be, because you may be traveling or otherwise predisposed where you can't take the quiz at that exact moment. So we do allow a block of time for you to take the quizzes, and then the quiz will be closed. And, you know, it's you know, sort of an honor system. I mean, you can look at your books, and you can look at notes and lecture materials as you're taking the quizzes. They're open book quizzes. What you're not supposed to do is collaborate with another student. In other words, you take the quiz on your own without talking to somebody else who's taken it, or without sitting down with somebody else in the course and taking it together. But you're certainly allowed to use materials, study materials, if you choose. Okay. So again, there's some other questions. There's a question about the labeling of higher order versus lower order goods, and we'll talk about that more in the course. There's a great question. Do I know of an intellectual family tree graphically for Austrian school scholarship? I have seen these presented on many occasions. I'm trying to think if I have a PowerPoint slide somewhere with an Austrian family tree. I don't know that I have one in electronic format, but I've seen them distributed by different Austrians. And you know, of course, there is no official Austrian family tree. There's some judgment required in how you link one person to another. But if somebody knows one, please post it. And I'd be delighted to see one created by any of you guys. If you have, maybe you can do one that's better than others that have been done. There's a question about Austrian economic theory and accounting. I think there is a strong connection between accounting and Austrian economic theory, in the sense that, right, I mean, accounting is basically common sense with some particular professional conventions, social conventions. But good Austrian economics is also common sense. And there is an important sense in which Mises' theory of economic calculation and the way we study the firm, the profit and loss of the firm, and the role of entrepreneur are all basically accounting questions. And it's not that you have to have, not that you have to be a CPA to understand Austrian economics. But yeah, I think there is. I think that professionals who are trained in accounting and finance and management and so forth often find Austrian economics much more congenial than the kind of mathematized, artificial neoclassical economics they might have been exposed to in college. There's a question about asking, you know, to what extent will this be a course in the history of economic thought? And my answer is, well, I mean, it will be in passing. But, you know, think of this as a course in so-called positive economics, meaning I'm going to be presenting the theory, and I will refer in passing to, you know, the evolution of doctrine But the main focus isn't who influenced whom and who said what to whom and who did what when and so forth. Of course, I think that's very interesting. The questioner is saying that he's reading Larry White's new book, which is called, I've forgotten the title, The Development, The Clash of Economic Ideas or something like that. I haven't read it, though I have seen some of the essays in draft form. I'm looking forward to reading the book in its entirety. I'm sure it's good. Larry White and I used to be colleagues at the University of Georgia, and he's a very, very bright Austrian economist. There are other more famous books. This questioner is asking specifically about Mark Blount's book, Economic Theory in Retrospect. I'm not as big a fan of Mark Blount's books as I am of other books in the history of economic thought, but that's something that we can talk about later. there's some smart alecky questions about how we're choosing to price the course, which I will choose not to answer this. There is a technical question, and Danny, maybe you can comment on this in the appropriate time. There's a question about whether this works for other versions of WebEx. Apparently you can't do it on the iPad version or the BlackBerry version, both of which I've tried, even though there are WebEx apps for iOS, for BlackBerry, probably for Android too. But I think you have to do it on a PC, a PC or a Mac. Why, I don't know, but that's the way it goes. There's some other questions that are good questions, but are really beyond the scope of this course or beyond my ability to answer, so I'm simply not going to answer them. Some people are asking, what's the difference between this and a mainstream mathematical course? If I've already taken a mainstream course, will I benefit from this course? The proof of the pudding is in the eating, but I hope I have kind of hinted already, and I hope that I can convince you if you take the course, that what we're doing here really is quite a bit different from the approach you get in a standard mainstream neoclassical mathematical economics text. So by no means will this material be redundant if you've already taken such a traditional course like that. I think you might find the course even more interesting, being able to compare it to the sort of standard approach. But just as I tried to articulate earlier, that Menger's economics is not merely a verbal, it's not just a verbal interpretation or restatement of Jevons and Barras. Likewise, the Austrian microeconomics that, we'll study over these 6 weeks is by no means a verbal restatement or a verbal interpretation of a mainstream microeconomics course. I think you'll find that they're quite different, and I hope that you'll like the difference. Let's see. We're going to wrap it up here in just a second here. I'm going to end with a question from Jordan. Are there still theories that have yet been discovered or understood using the Austrian way? Jordan, I hope this is what you meant, but the question is, is Austrian economics sort of already done, such that, just as... many religious traditions would say that, the truths are all in the scriptures already, we don't need to add to them. Is Austrian economics like that, where we have, human action as the Bible, and we don't need to add anything new to it? No, not at all. Nothing could be further from the truth, right? Austrians have a very healthy respect for their own tradition, right? And we think in most things, Menger got it right, Mises got it largely right, Rothbard got it largely right, but nobody got everything right, and we're always still trying to figure it out. We're kind of re-evaluating the doctrines that have been handed to us, trying to get inside of them and understand them and test them in a logical sense, right? Testing them against other parts of our knowledge, trying to decide what we think is right and wrong, trying to add to them, extend them, build them, develop them. So, you know, if you think of apply them to new problems, right, that's, of course, there's always a need to come up with new applications of Austrian theory because, of course, the world is always changing. And we need to, you know, apply our theories to real-world circumstances. But, you know, you think about a couple of extremes, right? An extreme on one side would hold that, you know, all truth is already in the great texts, and all we should do, you know, kind of like biblical hermeneutics is pour through the pages of human action and try to figure out what did Mises really mean here, right? At the other extreme, you could say, well, you know, I'm just going to start doing Austrian economics on my own. I'm just going to figure it out. I don't need to read any of that old stuff. Well, you know, I hold to a, you know, because I'm a reasonable and moderate kind of a guy, I hold to a middle ground position between those two extremes. Right? I mean, there is a magnificent corpus of economic insight that has been handed to us by the, you know, our great predecessors, by the great Austrian economists. And we should know it, right? It, you know, you, just like, you know, you wouldn't start building a house without having some training in house construction, without studying architecture and engineering and learning, you know, kind of being an apprentice maybe at the feet of a master builder before you go on and try to build something on your own. You know, scientific disciplines are no different. So, you know, all of us as students of the Austrian tradition, you know, when you read through Menger and von Bawerk and Mises and Rothbard and so on, you know, think of yourself as being an apprentice sitting at the feet of those great masters. And you want to learn what the masters have done. But that doesn't mean you have to be a slavish follower of any particular master, right? It's up to you to figure out what you think is right. And if you can go beyond, if you can refine, if you can reformulate, criticize, extend, well, of course, more power to you. That's great. Okay, well, it's 6:30, and that's I'm going to call tonight's teaser session to a close. So I hope, you know, like a drug addict, you're now kind of, you know, the prospect of me signing off and you not getting to hear me anymore is making you shake nervously and suffer, begin to suffer some withdrawal symptoms. Well, you know, the way to get your fix is to sign up for the course and join us again on July the 5th when we start with the real thing. So it's been great visiting with all of you guys tonight. Thank you so much, and I hope to see you on July the 5th. Good night.